Well, last week I told you that I had two options as to what we're going to do tonight, and I picked one. And that leaves a couple options that are ahead of us. I was going to do either Darby tonight, or I was going to do whatever the other part, which I am going to do tonight. Don't have a very good name for it. It's called background. We'll do Darby next week, and then we have a week off for Easter. You know, we don't meet on the week of Easter, you know, the Wednesday before Good Friday. And we pick it up again. So we just have 1 week off. And I'm looking forward to having a week off, catch up a little bit. So that's the plan. Darby and the Second Great Awakening, we'll do that. We'll probably be centered around Grandison Finney, because he seemed to be the big guy. But we'll talk a little bit about the Great Awakening tonight, Second Great Awakening, a little bit to get us started. It's a lot more difficult to deal with the Second Great Awakening, I think, because it's longer and the personalities are more varied, although we usually focus on Finney himself, and because he is such an influential person into even our day. So I have a lot of pieces tonight. I thought, I hope I don't get lost while I'm doing all this. I hope you don't get too lost. I guess the general subject is the period as soon as America is established in 1776, the few years that follow that, and then up into the early 19th century, and maybe even a little bit further, just in terms of the feel of the nation. And what's in my background when I'm talking to you about tonight's lesson is the fact that during this time, actually the century, really becomes a moralistic century under the flag of Christianity, and that seems to come out strongly. And I'll talk to you a little bit about who we're talking about in terms of the layers. You know, you don't have purity in layers. You just can't talk about born-again believers isolated from the ones that just call themselves Christians. They're living in the same place. They live in the same counties. They vote at the same places. They serve under the same, sometimes go to the same churches. So it's difficult sometimes to divide these out. So I'll explain how I do this, and it'll probably explain a little bit, well, how I'm doing it, difficulties with doing it. All right, so let's just get going. We have this figure of Go West, Young Man, Go West. The manifest destiny is part of this. And we'll talk about that, that America is expanding to the West with their Gentile Christianity, and it was have the idea of not only subduing the eastern coast, it's to take over the United States and actually be an influence in the entire world. So we are somewhere down where my arrow is. Christian influence in the Western world, kind of is a broad term, which isn't very good, but we're going to focus on the early American deal. So we have the Second Great Awakening in America. This is now the part three, the use of American independence. We are I moved this line over a little bit from where it was just to find that the Second Great Awakening actually started around maybe 1790 and sometimes 1800. And even what I'm going to give you today is not actually the beginning of it, but we got to pick some spot eventually. It'll be at Yale University, Yale College. Well, freedom. We talked about freedom. Last week we visited about the meeting point of the crossroads of the two great concurrent revolutions, one French Revolution and American Revolution. And much ink has been spilt over the similarities and dissimilarities of these great earthquakes in modern history. But there was one ideal both had in common, that was the idea of freedom. Of course, all freedoms are not created equal, nor do all bondages have the same restrictions. So got to be careful with the word freedom. It doesn't always mean the same thing. In France, it was freedom from God, in a sense, and the existing social and governmental structures. The great reforms in France nevertheless established an enduring administrative and legal system. Much of the revolutionary work in humanizing the law itself was subsequently incorporated into Napoleonic code. Politically, the revolution was more significant than it was successful. So in these years, we have democracy in France fails, and Napoleon comes on to the rescue. So the French Revolution lacked a sense of destiny, since God, in the nature of the Catholic Church, generally understood that way, had been made a non-essential. With nothing but humanism to drive ambitions, no guidance for morals or social order, democracy failed without a moral compass. Quickly, a foreign-born military leader, Napoleon, rose as a dictator who was easily embraced as a deliverer. Through his costly war exploits, France lost their substantial land claims to the New World, selling the Louisiana Purchase to the United States during the time of Thomas Jefferson. And he immediately hired Lewis and Clark to go explore his newfound land, which is a story in itself. The French survived its flawed revolution as a nation, but by the grace of God lived on to fill in God's given destiny in the 20th century, helping Israel. I'm not saying this is the only thing. I'm just picking one thing out. France had been a key weapon supplier to Israel in the 1950s and the first half of the 1960s. The French fighter jet made up the backbone of Israel's air force on the eve of the Six-Day War, 1967. Hoping to maintain its overseas empire in the face of mounting insurgencies, France had perceived common interests with Israel in confronting Arab nationalistic fervor, sweeping much of the Middle East and, in particular, its prized colony, Algeria. So in a short time, we had an alliance with France and Israel. Amazing. They supplied them the airplanes. The scale of the American Revolution is tipping, I'm talking this kind of scale, is tipping slightly in a different direction than in France, or maybe drastically, depending on how you look at it. As with the French, the unifying factor for the rebels was Thomas Paine's common sense, as it was with ours, remember? The United States did not have a wholesale fashion reject God as creator, provider, and sustainer of life. And by the way, that includes kind of all forms of that statement. With that said, it is a mistaken idea that many of the founders would have embraced a born-again theology as understood in the Great Awakening. They probably did not. There would have been some that would have, but not as a group. Now, sociologist Rodney Stark, some of us have read some of his work, as a sociologist out of Baylor, like his stuff, has this little chart about the religious participation in the early America. And he defines it as religious adherence. And I like that because you're probably most honest with that kind of answer. And when you adhere to a religion, you don't necessarily have to go to it. But, you know, you identify with it, which is probably what I'd like, rather than how much time to go to church. I want to know where their heart is. So if you see on the left, 1976, we have 17% of the Americans at that time go to or adhere to a religion. And I think that I've seen figures that are lower than that even. So we're going to have and I've been told in more than one place, as I've read, that it was at the lowest ebb right after the revolution. You'd think that that time maybe, if this is such a Christian insurgence, that that's a time they might get on, you know, to thank the Lord for the deliverance, but it's the absolute opposite. There's less participation. So again, it argues that it really didn't have a Christian legs for it after all. So you see that the percentages have gone up, and these percentages get to be wild. You get into the 1980s and 2000, we're at the 62% levels. That's better. I was thought it said 82, but it's 62. Well, that's kind of better. I couldn't imagine 82 being that high. So we have people that over time now seem to have more religious affinities than they did early America, which is the opposite of what you usually think. Now, in the post-revolutionary period, achieving a victory, and there's a little bit of American history for you, achieving a victory in the revolution was only the beginning of nation building. A governing agreement must be drafted and accepted. That is the Constitution. It wasn't until 11 years later that came about. It was a difficult time for the newly unified but yet severely divided Americans. Remember, people talk about the states hating each other. It wasn't like they did a kumbaya. That wasn't really there. They were independently, fiercely independent groups. The question remained unanswered. What is the balance between state versus federal powers of these nearly independent states of the United States? But the Constitution was a federalist idea to have one, and it obligated the states' cooperation and even divided over the question of Navy. Remember last week when we talked about the Barbary Wars, that the United States couldn't even float a Navy at that time, and to provide one was an issue amongst the colonies, whether you really want to go down that road. But if they're going to survive, they had to have a navy. So obviously they agreed and they unified themselves to that extent at that point. So as a compromise, now we have this Constitution. As a compromise, the later Bill of Rights meant to keep the federal government out of the lives of the citizens. So this was this argument that goes both ways. Eventually, the Bill of Rights was an amendment to the Constitution, was passed by each of the states. Now, in this passing of the First Amendment, we have the Religious Freedom Act, that we call it that. The United States Constitution prevents Congress from making any law respecting an establishment of religion, prohibiting the free exercise of religion, and going on, abridging free speech, freedom of press, the right to peaceably assembly, which we are, you know, benefactors of sitting here even tonight, or to the petition for government redress or of grievances. This is adopted in 1791 as a Bill of Rights. Well, we have the Federalist Papers, which were written to promote the idea of a federal government, and these were written unanimously. So when considering Jefferson's famous letter, which attributed to him, to the Danbury Baptist, most people only consider the phrase wall of separation, how it sounds to our modern ears. To us, this phrase sounds as if it is describing the impenetrable impasse which stands between our nation's religious institutions and her political institutions. Now, in the Christian era, out of the Bible, we find Paul uses this expression, and it becomes, into the vernacular, a popular expression, the wall of separation, which was meant to explain the separation between Jews and Gentiles, came to be used as a figure of speech for anything which prevented complete union between two groups. So when Jefferson wrote this, he was not referring to a completely impassable barrier, as Supreme Court Justice Frankfurter said in lived from up to 62. I'm not sure when he said this, so I couldn't find that. He was using a commonly understood phrase, Jefferson, to describe the fact that the First Amendment prevented the church and the state from achieving a complete union in America. They would always remain distinct entities, and the president of the nation would never be, as Jefferson described it, the legal head of the church, like Henry VIII was over England. This was the true intent of Jefferson's claim, and would be fortunate indeed if this intent were once again to be realized among us. I just noticed the guy that wrote this is Bill Fortenberry. I wonder whether he's in relationship to our senator, Jeff. I don't know. So you understand how that phrase comes in. This is a subject by itself. You could chase this down, how that was being used and how it is still being used against a Christian involvement or religious involvement in political affairs, because they said the church is to be kept out of the state, and the real idea here is that the state's to be kept out of the church. And, you know, with manipulative action, people have just turned it around to keep the church out of the state, and that is how it's been used for a lot of things, and that has decreased the morality of our nation immensely, because they considered it a separation of church-state issue. Well, with the ratification of the Constitution and functioning government, we had these presidents that I just list for you. The determinative war we're talking about a little history, the determinative war with Mother England further secures the United States as an international naval and military power. The War of 1812 settles British-American maritime disputes in the territories in the northwest of America, United States, between American and British Canadian interests. So we sort of have a solidified, contiguous nation geography. So I'm going to put in here just a comment about the first awakening, second great awakening, first awakening of the second time. First event, not the actual first, but it's early in the early, the second awakening. We'll talk about that. The first season of revival that came to Yale College during the second great awakening. The college president at that time was Timothy Dwight, a grandson of Jonathan Edwards. Timothy Dwight, number 4, actually it is. When Dwight assumed the reins of leadership at Yale in 1795, the college was at a most ungodly state, and only about 10% of the 125 students publicly professed to be Christians. This is a Christian school, remember. Lyman Beecher, who went on to become a famous New England minister, a junior, when Dwight arrived at Yale's president, Beecher reported of spiritual conditions at the school. The college church was almost extinct. Most of the students were skeptical, and rowdies were plenty. Wine and liquor were kept in many rooms. Intemperance, profanity, gambling, licentiousness were common. That was the day of the infidelity of the Tom Paine school. Remember Common Sense? The boys that dressed flax in the barn, worked in the barn, read Tom Paine and believed him. Most of the class before me were infidels and were called each other names like Voltaire, Rousseau. And so under the influence of the Enlightenment, anti-Christian philosophy, the students had come to doubt the reliability of Scripture. Shortly after Dwight's arrival at Yale, he accepted the seniors' challenge to debate the question, are the Scriptures of the Old and New Testament of the Word of God? And Dwight invited the students to mount the strongest case they could against the Bible, promising to assume that they personally believed, didn't have to believe everything they were arguing, but just set forth their arguments. After hearing them out, he then proceeded to systematically and meticulously demolish their case to capably construct a well-reasoned defense of the Bible's accuracy. For 6 solid months, Dwight preached a series of weekly sermons on the issue of biblical authority and accuracy. From that moment, infidelity was not only without a stronghold, but without a lurking place, so his son says. So subsequent periods of revival came to Yale in 1802, then 8, 12, 13, and so on. They kept recurring as new students would come in, I'm sure. New Haven, Connecticut is where Yale is located, also shared in the Awakenings. In an 1831 revival, 104 students became members of the college church, while 900 others in New Haven were converted. Now, we'll deal with the Enlightenment as such later, but I just want to mark the beginning of it for you in the context of the establishment of America. Also want to mention this point. We talked about that the second Great Awakening was an Arminian awakening, and we have this with Timothy Dwight. He's already moving away from his grandfather's Calvinism, moving towards an Arminian point of view. Now, this doesn't happen in one big step, but it's in the direction he is moving, in the direction in which he will argue. Another layer, the Golden Era. The Golden Era, 1856, was a 19th century San Francisco newspaper, the chief literary organ west of the Rocky Mountains. But I call this era the Golden Era of the United States. I'm not sure anybody else has done that. So describing the times of America, it seems that the entire century was the Golden Era of the United States. Now, this could be a lot of fun if you did this. Think about what life was like in 1800 and what it was like in 1900. Those 100 years were immensely profitable. Now, we may say from 2000 to 2100, that was, 1900 to 2000, whatever, that 100 years was profitable too for us. And it was, but probably in a different way, but anyway, we talk about going from whale oil lamps to electric lights. We talk about faster communication. I'm always impressed with this, that the fastest way you get a word out in those days was a galloping horse, which I think could go 40 miles an hour. That's probably the top speed. Is that right? Something like that. Nothing goes faster. It had nothing else. So I thought smoke signals from Indians, but they don't go very far, So you don't have anything except what a horse can do in terms of speed. At the end, we have telegraph, got telephone. So we go from manpower, horsepower, to fossil fuel energy. Now, we probably don't stop to think about this a lot, but this is huge in our life. The things that we used to do by manpower, just pick up things, it's done by fossil fuels. And that's probably why it's being attacked so much by the left. But fossil fuel energy, driving internal combustion engines and other things, is immensely labor-saving for us. Cotton gin, I didn't look at the data up in the cotton gin. Locomotives and transportation by trains, hauling things. To the edge of the atmospheric flight, we had balloons already, but not winged aircraft, but Orville Wright and those guys were flying about 1906. So we have used to bleed for cures. Then we have scientific cures and medicines. We start having inoculations for diseases. We have the shedding of slavery as a drain on the economy. We have the beginning of photography about in the middle of the century, the automobile towards the end of the century, widespread religious participation, and you could just go on and on and on about things that happened in the 19th century that were good. So it's hard to overstate the prospects of the 19th century. The revolutions changed many things. Perhaps one of the most profound was to release the individual from strings that bound him to rigid structures, structures which were religious, social, and economic. This relief would include all innovations, particularly scientists, industrial, and medical, and again, the list could go on. So the man, individual, was released to provide or produce a potential, a higher potential than before, because nothing would restrict him. The release of the individual to innovate makes progress, is making progress perhaps the most significant event, even though it was unintended, out of the American Revolution, and it targeted individual freedom. Well, we may think that focus on individual is a good thing or maybe a bad thing. I tend to think it's a good thing. But then on the other side, there is the loss of the community, a connection of equals. The Christian point is that the individual is responsible separately before his creator God and falls or stands by that relationship. Humanism, on the other hand, the groupthink, says that which the group should, says it's the group that should stand before God and they should all rise and fall together. You can see how you can hide in a group and not feel personally responsible. The revolution cut the ties with the English church. You talked about that. The disestablishment of the church and the state. Ideas of the Baptists were rampant. Started with Roger Williams and others. It cut the church ties to the government. The Great Awakening made religious experience personal, individual, rather than salvation by the groups, as in a baptized membership. The ordination of the ministers, although kept on doing it, of leaders was not required for meetings off of church properties. For example, many of those were led by lay, unordained men, not beholden to a hierarchy. In fact, there is an awful lot said about the, we might call them Bible study groups that were outside the church, were met in homes, that was a tremendous help for people, no matter whether saved or not. I mean, that's where they met outside the church, and they were led by unordained people. So now into this century, we have these currents flow together. We have democracy, we have Christianity, we have freedom. They're somehow woven together as one cord, and I said on the bottom, brought to you by your local Gentiles, because that is all we're talking about here. We're not talking about any Jewish consideration here. In Christianity at all is that it's a Gentile event. And democracy comes by Christianity and freedom comes by Christianity. So Christianity is the center of this cord tied with church and state. Not tied together, but, you know, they depend on their religion to carry this forward. So once religious freedom was achieved, and it was achieved early in America, as I read to you, social and economic freedoms followed quickly. This combination of events brought on the golden century. We may think of the 20th century as the golden years. However, in comparison, I believe it fails. The 20th century had two great wars of global consequence. It saw the adoption of legal, liberal religious and political ideas, which led to unwinnable politically managed wars, plus the rotting of the moral core of the country. What the 19th century gained, it seems to me like in a moral sense, the 20th century lost. And I think it's still leaking. So in making our general observation of the 19th century, we must remember that Christianity was the uncontested, that's a Protestant Christianity, was the uncontested religion of the people. There were others, of course, who were irreligious and, you know, atheists, perhaps. I put Catholics in there because they saw them as different. But Christianity based on the Bible, had a Protestant, Puritan morality. You know, as time passed, now we're a couple of hundred years away from 1620 and 1630, as time passed, the new birth aspect of the Puritans gave way to a moralism, an Arminianism, wherein man's condition remains savable if he chooses it for himself. And here we have Timothy Dwight pushing in that direction. So as the French Revolution removed God and the consequences of his being from the French life, the American retained a version of the Creator God and sought divine purposes in the newfound national existence. After 1812 war, there was a spirit of optimism of God's blessing America to bring about moral good and then a moral kingdom. Hopefully in the coming of the Messiah to claim his kingdom after it had been established, the newfound America with its new freedom was the harbinger of the days of glory to come. So we look down in the 1800s as we peer into the middle decades to see this elevated optimism and religious fervor. We have a visiting Frenchman observing Americans as highly religious, unparalleled, he says, in the world. He says, Christianity is the companion of liberty and all its conflicts, the cradle of its infancy and the divine source of its claim, Tocqueville. He goes on, upon my arrival in America, United States, the religious aspect of the country was the first thing that struck my attention. And the longer I stayed there, the more I perceived the great political consequences resulting from this new state of things. In France, I had almost always seen the spirit of religion and spirit of freedom marching in opposite directions. But in America, I found that they were intimately united, reigned in common over the same country. I do not know whether all Americans have a sincere faith in their religion, for who can search the human heart, but I am certain that they hold it to be indispensable to the maintenance of Republican institutions. This opinion is not particular to a class of citizen or to a party, but it belongs to the whole nation and to every rank of society. The term manifest destiny first appeared in a newspaper article on the annexation of Texas, in addition, August of the United States Magazine and Democratic Review in 1845. The author, John L. O'Sullivan, used it to describe what a majority of Americans at that time believed was their mission from God, to expand to the West and bring the United States government to an unenlightened people. It was also firmly anchored in a long-standing and deep sense of a special and unique American destiny, the belief that, in the words of historian Conrad Cherry, America is a nation called to a special destiny by God. The notion that there was some providential purpose to European discovery and the eventual conquest of the land masses discovered by Christopher Columbus was present there from the beginning, he says. Both the Spanish and the French monarchs authorized and financed explorations of the New World because, among other things, they considered it their divinely appointed mission to spread Christianity to the New World by converting the natives to Christianity. Coming later to the venue, the British, and especially the New England Puritans, that carried with them a demanding sense of the providential purpose. Remember, they came all over as the New Israel, remember? Then as the Puritans came, John Winthrop, one of the governors at the Bay of Colony, this is now a couple hundred years back, so it was the beginning of this, gave the clearest and most far-reaching statement of the idea that God had charged the English settlers in New England with a special and unique providential mission on board the Arabella on the Atlantic Ocean, 1630. Winthrop delivered the blueprint for what Perry Miller has dubbed an errand into the wilderness, which set the framework for most of the later versions of the idea that America had been providentially chosen for a special destination. Winthrop delivered his lay sermon just before he and his fellow passengers disembarked on the shores of the Boston Harbor, the place Winthrop proposed, to which God had called them to build up a model biblical commonwealth for Protestants in England and everywhere to emulate. Thus stands the cause between God and us. We are entered into a covenant with him for this work. We have taken out a commission, he declared, adding, if the Lord shall please to hear us and bring us in peace to the place we desire, then hath he ratified this covenant and sealed our commission, and will expect a strict performance of the articles contained in it. Almost thinks like he's a Moses. Even through the fog of the 20th century, we still have a glimmer of this vision in the phrase exceptionalism. The convictions of the United States as a Christian nation has been challenged from many quarters, mostly likely, from those who choose to deny God and to allow the attribution of any acts to him. Then there have been the losses mentioned in the 20th century that have moved the United States to a secular humanism, at least in its leadership, in its publicness, and no matter what the protest, the slides continue. Now, we return to last week's point that once the Jews and the coming kingdom are eliminated from God's work in the way you think, it becomes necessary to insert another purpose for history. And we've just seen it being done in Christian America. Here, then, it is inserted and assumed a Christianity with the church as its representation. That the church has replaced Israel had currency, remember, from the second century, clear on down to the 19th. And in some quarters, continues on to today. Now, we mentioned our authors, Noel Hatch and Matt Marsden, good authors, all reject the idea of a Christian nation, a brave assessment on their part, but have yet to insert a new plan since they too have rejected the Jewish hope as the end of history. Their title, The Search for a Christian America, gives us a clue that they have not acquired a valid purpose for the church either. In fact, the last chapter is telling in their title, and it says, The Search Continues. While the idea that America had a world-saving destiny from God worked for a while, but it was when those expectations did not work out that the reassessment became necessary. I'll jump ahead. That break came after World War I, especially after World War II. What we call postmillennialism lost its currency. That long, it took that long. But for a large part of Christianity, abandoning one thing, a Christian America, but not embracing another idea, leaves history, past and future, in some state of waiting. I call it the unfinished symphony. Put Jews back into history and prophecy with the kingdom, and it's fixed. Is it possible that they did have a divine sense of purpose or destiny? Perhaps was it just a misguided? Was it just misguided in that they saw themselves as a replacement, as the peoples of God? Perhaps if they would have read their Bibles more carefully, they might have reserved judgment regarding God's act and deal he had accomplished them. So did the 19th, 20th century dispensationalists expect a Jewish nation to be formed? I say surely they did. Did they see how the West and America too would be used? Not likely. But keeping the spiritual eyes fixed on Israel, some sense can be made of history, even in retrospect. I don't mean you have to be able to tell the future, and we're not historicists either. Now, sifting layers, I'm trying to explain something to you. When somebody teaches you, you'd like them to tell you the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God. All right, so but it's difficult to do this when you talk about history because you cannot talk about anything in its purity. So I call them layers. You have these layers, and every history, is every day, even today, this is stacked up with layers. Depending on which part of the day you look at, who you're talking about, where you're going, who's doing what, you have a layer. So when you look back in history, you have these layers, and when I'm teaching it, I understand that there is a bleed through these layers, and you're sitting there thinking there's none, because what I'm saying about the born again, that's true for all Christians. Well, I'm saying, no, it's not. So I got to juggle back and forth. I'm just going to explain that to you a little bit. So all history is layered. These layers are identifiable as places, people, and things, for example, and they are associated within layers. And we can study the present United States as a layer, but while doing that, we'll touch on other layers like social issues, economic issues, religious beliefs, and their families, and so forth. So also we bleed into other areas. So each layer is not an isolation, and there is an ongoing transmigration of information between the layers. So in our studies, the layers of the acts and the identities of the truly born again easily mixes with the layers of those who may not or who may or may not be born again. That's really the issue. Are we talking about believers here, or are we talking about people that look like believers that aren't believers? Remember, Tocqueville says you can't tell the heart, and I thought that's one thing, and it said it was true. So what a secular Christian does may look exactly like what's being done by a born-again person, you know, on a particular given day or particular event. You can't tell by what they do necessarily, unless it's an immoral thing, but many things aren't immoral. So our difficult task to keep track of these layers and assign responsibilities or event in history that is unique to them, and I say that can be challenging. Therefore, I say we cannot really talk about a Christian America as a layer. These are the Christians in America. I don't think you can do it. And I think Noel and Hatch and Marsden make that point. These layers are mixed. And whatever we say about any layer is probably misleading because it isn't true of everything in the layer. So far, we have not made an issue between the born again and the secular Christians. I don't think it's possible. Although I think we can talk about born again Christians. But in terms of where they fit in the layers, I think it's very, very difficult. So far, we have not made an issue between the born-again and the secular Christians because it is impossible to keep the layers separate and pure. So we will continue this practice and not try to sort it out. If, for example, the person is holding to these ideals of the manifest destiny, are they born-again or not? I don't know. there surely must have been many who were affected by the Jewish replacement ideas and presumed that position as biblical, and surely some did protest that replacement, as we will see, and in the end, it only matters to our discussion what they actually did. All right, I don't know if that makes any sense to you. I'm not sure it made any sense to me. But I just don't want to try to be put in a box to say, well, these are Christians doing this, and why do these people do this? Are they not Christians? I can't explain that. I don't know that I can. I don't. That's why I say I know that. I don't know whether it makes any difference. It does as far as God's concerned, but as far as what we evaluate, I'm not sure it can be explained. Okay, now we're going to go into prophecy. The errors in the early American prophetic expedition did not fly in on a cargo plane. They were not administered at gunpoint at some revolutionary dictator. The heirs came in with a family of Christians who did not have courage to call out the eschatological illegitimacy. So to me, it's like the dodo bird. I guess it's extinct now. I didn't realize that. I think probably it makes sense that it is. The dodo bird accepts the eggs of other birds. It is by its own stupid action unaware that she is creating her own demise, because she's not sitting on her eggs. Her chicks aren't going to get hatched. And you do that long enough, there won't be any more dodo birds. So the Christians have accepted the dodo bird position and hatched other people's eggs and to their own demise. So in the process of it, millennialism has been corrupted, and I think that is the beginning of the end. So a corrupted premillennialism, it all started in the 2nd century to Augustine, 5th century, where it allegorized the literal kingdom, making it a spiritual one without any Jewishness, very important part. And we notice the order. If you reject the Jews, you got to allegorize the reading. When you allegorize the reading, you make the Bible a wax nose in order to spiritualize the kingdom. And when you spiritualize the kingdom, the church assumes it. And then all of a sudden, we find out the church really doesn't have anything to do because it really wasn't created for that. So we have our author saying, where is the in search of Christian America? Okay, now, the French Revolution, about the millennium here. By the way, you cannot avoid the millennium. I don't care if you're an unbeliever, read the Bible, or you're a believer, read the Bible. You're amillennialist, premillennial. You got to deal with the millennium because it happened 6 times in Revelation chapter 20, and it cannot be avoided. Okay, so it's part of the Bible. So we have all these views, premillennialism, biblical, pro-Israel. You have premillennialism, historic, anti-Jewish. You have amillennialism, Augustine, anti-Jewish. Premillennialism, historicism, a warning to Jews. We have postmillennialism, anti-Jewish. We have premillennialism, pro-Jewish. And there are maybe some others. So we have to deal with the millennium. You just can't say, well, don't care about that. I want to be a pan-millennialist. You can't be. There's no such position. So we have to deal with it. Now I'm going to try to explain this to you. And I could have rewritten this, but I didn't have time. So I'm going to try to explain it to you. So with millennialism, I'm having a hard time tonight with words. With millenarianism tonight, and I'm going to say like us at this point, most frequently the expression of the sectarian minority party, that's us, and the Augustinian point of view supported by the established authorities, that's them, the disputes have usually been marked by claims on the part of the millenarians, us, that we were restoring apostolic Christianity. We say premillennial, that is basic Christianity. We need to go back to the Bible. Whereas they turn around and accuse us of being full of heresy and fanaticism. So this is the problem. So the most recent antecedent to the early 19th century millenarians, somewhat like us, had been the Puritans, particularly a radical party known as the Fifth Monarch Men. Now, if you ever read that again, just that Fifth Monarchy comes out of the order of the Bible kingdoms like Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Roman. Then what follows is the fifth, because we've had 4, right? So it's the fifth one. So it's kind of like a millennial statement. So there were some in the Puritans thought that they would become the millennial rule king group. Said they're called the Fifth Monarchy. Well, that was an embarrassment, and of course that wasn't good. So in reaction to the excesses of this Fifth Monarchy, of the Puritan Revolution, millenarianism, fell to disfavor in the 18th century, 1700s. But churchmen did not return to Augustine. They didn't go back to amillennialism. Okay? They rejected premillennialism, or the version that the Puritans had, but they did not go back to Augustine, which was no millennium. So a harmony of Lockean tradition and rationalism and optimism, words, the new eschatology, most influentially started by Salisbury rector Daniel Whitby, who was a post-millennialist, new word here, emphasized the continuing success of the church, the speedy improvement of man and society, and the eventual culmination of Christian history in the coming of a literal millennium. So therefore, it's post-millennium. The Lord will return after the millennium. So it's only at the end of that blessed age that Christ's second coming was expected. All right, I'm going to skip this. In fact, I'm going to skip a lot of this stuff. I'd like to, because that's difficult to get a hold of. But the point I'm trying to make for you tonight, it's in the French Revolution, where we now call the new postmillennialism, took root, which continued to last for 150 years, is out of the French Revolution. So I'm going to go on. These new progressive millennialists refused to accept the pervasive allegorizing of Augustine, didn't want to go back to do that, and anticipated that an age of world peace and harmony would dawn upon the earth. But they were also confident that, in opposition to the premillennialists, which thought it would take war and violence for it to come, they thought the era could be brought in without any supernatural invention. They just come peacefully. Okay. No tribulation, in other words. Now, the French Revolution is directly responsible for the revival of the prophetic concern. To live through the decade of the 1790s in itself constituted an experience in apocalypse for many of the British. Remember the two cities by, who was it? Dickens, thank you. So the English were watching what was going on in France. The violent uprooting of European political and social institutions forced many to the conclusion that the end of the world was near. And just at that time that the apocalyptic cosmology seemed the most realistic outlook, one of the biblical prophecies appeared to have been exactly fulfilled. In the famous passage of Daniel 7, the prophet described a procession of four fanciful animals, each symbolizing an empire, the last of which possessed 10 horns. In Daniel's vision, the little horn grew up among the 10 horns, rooting out 3 of them. In the interpretation of the prophecy, Daniel 7, the little horn was stated to be the king or ruler who would wear out the saints of the Most High and to think to change times and laws, that they should be given into his hand a time and times and the dividing of times. You know the passage. I've been through it on Sunday morning. In Revelation 13, a somewhat similar beast with 10 horns was described as enduring for 42 months. And the two visions were traditionally interpreted by Protestants as two descriptions of the same event, the tyrannical reign of the Pope for 1260 years. As unbelievable events of 1790 unfolded, the students of apocalyptic literature became convinced that they were witnessing the fulfillment of the prophecy of Daniel 7 and Revelation 13. The revolution brought the cheering sight of the destruction of the papal power in France, the confiscation of church property, and eventually the establishment of a religion of reason. The final act occurred in 1798 when French troops under Berthier, whatever name is, marched on Rome, established a republic, and sent the Pope into banishment. Commentators were quick to point out that this deadly wound received by the papacy had been explicitly described in Revelation 13:3, the wound who healed. Although prophetic scholars had previously been unable to agree on what date to assign to the rise and fall of the papal power, it now became clear after the fact that the papacy had come to power in 538, which is about right. So it's not papal power of Rome, which was once so terrible and so dominating, is not the papal power of Rome, which was once so terrible and so domineering, at an end. Now, this is a quote here we're reading. But let us pause a little. Was not this end in other parts of the holy prophecies foretold to be at the end of 1260 years? And was it not foretold by Daniel to be at the end of time, a times and a half time? Which computations amounts to the same period? Now let us see, hear, and understand this year is 1798, and just 1,260 years ago, in the very beginning of the year 538. And that put the end to the empire of the Romans. So that's where these years started. Now, our minds have to go a little bit like this because, you know, he's doing something wrong with it. But he's using these years and saying, well, the Pope came to rule back in there. Now it's the end of the time. So 1260 years, days were actually years. And now the French Revolution is the end of time. So thus, in a sense, the special significance of the French Revolution to the student of prophecy, the cataclysm, undermined the progressive and rationalist cosmology of the 18th century, but in most importantly, its most important contribution to the millennium revival was the spur it provided to future prophetic prophecy studies. So the identification of the events of the 1790s and those prophesied in Daniel 7 and Revelation 13 provided biblical commentaries and prophetic Rosetta Stone. They had something to match off or key off of. At last, a key had been found in which to crack the code. There could now be a general agreement among the one fixed point in correlation between the prophecies and history. After 1799, in Egyptology as in prophecy, it seemed as though there were no limits to the possibility of discovery. And now that's where the post-millennium stays put. So this more clearly defined eschatology outlook was now the underlayment of America in the 19th century. A Christianizing of America was becoming a reality, perhaps at the hands of misguided Christians that began to appear in the Second Awakening, already in progress, as we saw at the turn of the 19th century. So freedom from restrictive structures, interpreted as a freedom of Christ, loosened the innovative talents that will capitalize on individual effort to build up home, country, and God with a righteous sense of moralism. So all this was possible by believing, as historicists do, that the events of the history are identifiable in the Bible. But with the only observable people rejected, that is the Jews, any attempt to find the Gentiles in history will be mistaken. Only dispensational premillennialism connects the dots and finishes the symphony. It just basically said the literature from now on is all over the map. And you can imagine, they just took a part of it and made part of it fit. They didn't worry about the rest of it. They just took a piece of it. They didn't worry about the rest of it. When you do that, you got other things to work at. So a lot of people were writing, and they wrote under pseudonyms. They didn't want to know who they were. So that just went on. We have a guy that's going to come up here by the name of Way, John Way, and I'm not going to talk about him tonight because I'm not sure I'm going to deal with him later, but he becomes one of the first guys for this Jewish recovery. So we will move into the next section. I think I gave you this to you last week, so this is where he quit. We move into the next section. Remember that no organized system known as dispensational premillennialism exists. If there was an accepted system, it would be an anemic form of postmillennialism built on historicism as a way to understand the Bible. But these terms were not available then. Say they're simply Christians without any system to measure status or progress, much less ultimate conclusions. They adhered to a mild or vague postmillennialism as the best classification, as we would call it. So only dispensational premillennialism has anything to say about Gentiles and Jewish history. Since the early church fathers have taken the Jews out of God's work, they have had a hard time putting Gentiles into the vacuum. But by leaving the Jewish promises in, which is our perspective, we can write history from a Jewish vantage point that is a dispensational premillennial disappointment, and we can connect the dots. So pick the right fork. Take the one to the left, you go to the kingdom, God restores his creation. Go to the right, you get into spiritualizing things, and you end up with a Platonic Augustine heaven, which is in another dimension, somewhere else in outer space, and this earth is destroyed. That's very much amillennialism, not postmillennialism.